Africans at home and throughout the diaspora. Unity is strength. We've got the power.
Stop the fussing and the fighting. Now's the time to do the right thing.
We need more unity. Come.
Stop the fussing and the fighting. Now's the time to do the right thing.
In the spirit of Umoja, embrace with love.
Let's do it right now. We've got to do it right. Stop the fussing and the
right
fighting.
Right now,
now's the time to do the right thing.
Yes, we are going to do the right thing because that's all we can do, you all. This is Jamala Rogers, your host of Voices from the Battlefield, and we are set for a dynamic program today. But remember, this is a place where we bring folks who are on the battlefield. They are fighting for democracy, fighting for economic justice, for political power. And these battlefields could be housing. They could be a police accountability, healthcare, education. And oh my goodness, do we have a battlefield on the education battle? So we're going to try to get somebody in to talk about our St. Louis public schools soon. But until then, we have a very special guest. And, you know how I feel, as I've told you all how I feel, about folks who preserve, protect, respect, continue our Black history and culture. And we have one such person today, and so I'm totally excited. But I do want you to know that opinions expressed on this show are not necessarily those of Harris Stowe State College or University or Black Radio Hall of Fame. But we are going to have lots of information. These are facts, y'all. These have been researched again and again by not just my guests but other folks. So I really want you to introduced to some, but maybe some of you all know Linda Nance. She is the president of the Annie Malone Historical Society, but she also has done work with the National Colored Women.
National Association of Colored Women's Clubs.
I knew it was a colored in there. I remember the color part, but she is a historian in her own right and has helped to bring some of these stories to light for us. And I'm going to have you back on in probably the spring, because I think that still the Annie Malone story is not known to our people. They know about the parade, but who is the parade named after? So welcome to Voices from the Battlefield, Linda Nance.
Thank you, Jamal.
Yeah. So we're going to be talking about racism and the St. Louis World's Fair of 1904. And it's a little interesting because 1904 was not the original date of completion. So tell us a little bit about where this came from, where the idea came from. I know the Louisiana Purchase is in there somewhere, but give the audience a bit of a history about what the World's Fair was, why it was at this particular time, and what did it all entail?
Good question. David Francis, once the mayor of St. Louis, once the governor of the state of Missouri, once representing us with the federal government, had the idea that we should have a World's Fair in St. Louis. The World's Fair was an opportunity to show the world the best of America, the best of what civilization could even offer. And he tried his best, even prior to the time we had it, to bring it here, but he failed the first time. And it was supposed to be in 1903, which was a celebration of the 100th anniversary of the Louisiana Purchase. But we couldn't do that because we weren't ready to do that. And we needed to raise more money. We needed to raise more buildings. And even though the buildings were temporary buildings for the most part, we still needed to make sure that they were up. And the goal of David Francis was to make this the most outstanding, the most grandiose piece that ever happened. So There was a lot of advertising done throughout the country, throughout the world, bringing people the knowledge that this was going to happen here in 1904. And from April the 30th until December the 1st in 1904, we had the biggest celebration that you can imagine here in St. Louis. Brought people, almost 20 million people, to St. Louis in that very short time frame. It cost 50 cents to get into the fair, and people came from all over the world to do that. And, of course, the National Association of Colored Women was a part of that group that intended to meet here. And I say intended because they did not come onto the grounds as a group. They decided to boycott the fair because of all the racism that they saw here.
Now, were they originally scheduled to be a part of it? They were invited, or were they already going to be doing something there?
They were going to have their meeting, their biennial, every 2 years, meeting there. It would have been the fourth biennial meeting since their organization. The National Association of Colored Women were the first organized group of black women in the United States. And they were going to have their participation be known in this place for two reasons. Number one, they were Americans. They wanted to be a part of this large spectacle. The other was they thought it was a great opportunity to show America what black women have done since emancipation. And they were very proud of that. They brought the best and the brightest. They were an organization of women. Whether you were a maid or whether you had a maid, they were there. And they were organized to look at issues dealing with women, children, and families. That's what they were about. And they wanted to elevate anything and everything that had to do with that. They supported. Their motto, in fact, was lifting as we climb.
I remember that. And a lot of times you've seen posters with that, but you never know who the original, where the original quote came from. Well, they certainly pushed the boundaries and probably were the first ones to red flag the way that folks were going to be treated just by the way that they were being treated. But I don't think in their wildest dreams did that they know that there was going to be these anthropological villages where people would of color would be put in cages and on display. I don't think they knew that part. Probably would have had a real protest.
No, I don't think they did. Not to that extent. In fact, they were to meet in July and have their meeting on the grounds. And there were a couple of ladies that decided to go check out where they were going to be. Margaret Murray Washington was one of the people who came. We had a couple of other ladies to come. And one of them, who was a well-educated lady, who had degrees, taught at Wilberforce, had visited England, had traveled all over the world lecturing about the state of African Americans in the United States. She offered herself her application for employment, and they turned her down.
First red flag, or I should say white flag.
They attempted to get water, and they were not allowed to get water at the same stations that white people got water from. They attempted to buy souvenirs or other products, and they were denied the opportunity to do that.
So, Linda, stop. I want to remind people that this was in 1902.
Four.
So this was long after Emancipation Proclamation. It was after, you know, so-called segregation. So here we are. And I remember reading something about this where it was not, and maybe it wasn't in relationship to the fair, but it was this notion that in Missouri, particularly in St. Louis, there were these unspoken dividers of race, even though they didn't have colored only, white only. And it seems like this speaks to that right now, where they couldn't even get water. And if you understand, in that time of the summer, it was pretty hot.
Yes. Absolutely.
Wow.
Missouri, St. Louis particularly, has all kind of weather all the time. Everybody knows that who lives here. So from April to December, you got a lot of things going on. And supposedly because there was a human zoo that gave their natural habitats, and not everyone was behind bars as if a real zoo, it was supposed to be more humane. It was supposed to be an anthropological piece that allowed the white people in that particular time frame to see what the brown communities of the world were like. And although that was true, the whole point was to show the savages, the people who were inferior to the white race.
And in fact, Linda, there was a categorization of these folks as they were coming. They were either categorized as savage or civilized. And right. The civilized label went to those folks who were most open or willing to adopt Western civilization, or I should say white folk civilization. And so
colonization.
Yeah, it's true. Absolutely. Colonization. So the darker hued folks, which would be the Africans, were savages. And as you got lighter, the Filipinos would be civilized. And I think, you know, the situation of Philippines is particularly strategic. So I want you to talk about how they came to be, for example, the biggest of the exhibit. I think it's a thousand of them that was brought to the...
More than a thousand were brought to St. Louis.
And then last couple of weeks ago, you all had the special event at the Missouri Historical Society where this exhibit is now on display. And there was a Filipino woman by the name of Rhea Unson who had a relationship to this exhibit through her foreparents. So talk about what happened with her people and then what was happening with the Filipinos there.
Well, the special caveat is that the United States had recently won the war in 1902, I want to say.
Yeah, it was.
With the Philippines. And they were trying to and felt that the fair would be an excellent opportunity to showcase their newest conquest and give them an opportunity to learn about our culture. So they brought more than 3,000 people here from the Philippines of every kind of community that they had. They brought all kinds of people. They put them in different villages that were significant to what their ethnic group was within the Filipino group. And Rhea was a descendant of her relative was there in that village. They were part of a special group that was brought to St. Louis to Americanize them, so to speak. And they wanted them to go back to the Philippines and talk about how wonderful it was in the United States. So it was definitely a contrived and intentional kind of thing that they be there. There were people from brown people, I should say, from all over the world showcased, and not always in the best light. There were multiple tribes of Indians here. There were people from China and Japan. There were just people who were brown people from around the world who were represented here and not necessarily in the best light or treated with respect.
So I'm wondering, this anthropological experiment of bringing all these folks here, that was even in itself a momentous kind of coordination. Was there universities involved with this? I mean, how did they identify them? Obviously, some had to do a certain amount of study about the individual tribes, whether it be the indigenous people here in this country or in the Philippines. There's numerous, I mean, it's numerous dialects, numerous tribes. Who decided who was coming, and then how did they recreate that habitat here at the World's Fair?
Again, we're talking about extreme intentionality. There was attached to the different committees that planned for the fair an anthropologist who helped them make those decisions, who helped to organize those things to get visas and different things that people needed to enter this country. It was a contrived, very purposeful kind of thing. And the representation they felt was absolutely necessary to show what they intended to show, which was the inferiority of other peoples, with an S.
Right, right. And I think when people understand that, then the rest of it does make sense. And I think the word that you used was conquest, because part of it was to show or contrast how folks in this country, based on how they lived, how they looked, were far superior I mean, there's no criteria for they used other than you know, how they were looking in color. But one of the things, even for to bring Chief Geronimo, who had been a celebrated warrior amongst his own people, here he was on display. You know, it's just so humiliating to me. I mean, I just can't even imagine how these people felt. Now, I know that he did write about that. Did you have a chance to look at some of the things he wrote about with his particular participation in such a racist?
You know? I have not read any of his writings, so I cannot speak to that.
Yeah, that would be interesting.
But I do know he was here.
Yeah.
And he did allow people to take his image. Mm-hmm. And the fair required him to turn over the majority of those funds.
Yeah, because he was not only taking pictures, he was autographing them and people would pay him.
That's right.
So he couldn't even keep the money that he was earning.
Not entirety. its entirety, no.
Wow, he was not. That's totally
so
messed
again,
up.
That's some intentional kind of thing that was going on. They were also required to perform in certain rituals that they did. Some of the celebratory things that they did on special occasions, they were required to do on a routine basis.
Wow.
And they did have fair people in management that went to make sure they did these things at a particular time and did them in a particular way. Some of them were specifically selected to make them even appear more of a savage than they would have in their celebratory kinds of things.
Absolutely. I'm going to pin that because I have a question about that. But just to go back to Chief Geronimo, because when you had talked earlier about the conquest, he represented the conquest over red nations here in the Americas, that they had totally wiped out, you know, not totally, but wiped out, large portions of the indigenous people here, and those that they didn't were forced upon reservations. So he also represented a certain conquest, like,
absolutely.
Yes, he's here, but he's here at our bidding, and we... controlling the whole thing, and they're subject to our civilization or our laws now. And so it just, you know, the whole thing just seems insidious. But I wanted to go back to your question, I mean, your statement about the way that people were participating. How did they get people to sign up? It certainly was not like slavery where they just came and snatched people, stole us. But was there a certain compliance with what was going on? Did they promise them this nice life? I mean, how would they get that many people to come over here?
That I really don't know.
Yeah, that's other amazing.
Other than the attraction of being in one of the biggest things happening in the world at the time.
Well, they wouldn't necessarily know that.
Well, I would suppose because of all the advertisement, or should I say propaganda, that was there, I do believe that was a part of it. I asked the same question, and I have not been able to find an answer that tells me or been able to see some kind of newspaper article that says we're asking people to come to the United States to be a part of the World's Fair. Other than as a visitor, I've seen those, but I've not seen anything that asks people to come and be a participant in the World's Fair as an exhibit.
As an exhibit.
I haven't seen anything like that.
Yeah, that would be curious to find out, because I'm thinking in 1904, and I'm looking at the communications models that we had, we didn't have internet, we didn't have cell phones. So for a tribe to have been recruited, they wouldn't be looking at the news to say, oh, something fantastic is happening in a place called St. Louis, Missouri that we never heard of.
I think the unit, especially with looking at Indian tribes, I don't think that was a thing that was a voluntary thing. I would think that the United States basically said, this is what you need to do at this particular time. But I cannot prove that because I haven't seen that for myself.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I don't know that I saw any answers to that particular question as part of the exhibit. And we do want people to know the exhibit is at the museum, the Missouri History Museum. It's a whole section of the museum that I just really encourage people to go. And, you know, if you didn't go to the event that you all did, it was, to me, really helped to explain some of the exhibits and the rationale, because the questions that people were asking kind of helped dig a little bit deeper. And I was curious, again, about the role of Rhea Unson. But, you know, one of the things that David Walsh said that I thought hoped fell on the hearts and minds of the people there, and he talked about, you know, the truth is not always comfortable or without some pain, but we got to tell it.
We have
to tell it. And so I know a lot of people don't know about the level of racism and white supremacy that was exhibited, exuded from this fair, but they also, a number of them, don't want us to talk about it. They want to see the grandiose nature of the fair. And I think we should talk about that, because if people knew how much space this took out, how much money it took, I think, about 3 years. That's why they were off schedule. I mean, it was a humongous project. So, yeah, so I could understand how white people in particular say, wait a minute, we had this fantastic thing. Don't mar it with the talk about racism just because we had some exhibits there that had people on display like they were like subhuman beings. We, you know, that was the times then.
Well, I got to back up and do a little plugging here. You talk about the Thursday night event, the Thursday night at the museum. That was an opportunity to talk about lots of different facets of the fair. This is the third time, I understand, that the World's Fair exhibit has been renovated. And this is the first time, however, that it has attempted to tell the full story of the fair. So I have to give them a thumbs up for that one. I appreciate their effort that they put into that. I also have to say that there's a book that has been put together. It's called The Wonder and Complexity of the 1904 World's Fair. And they have a number of different people who have written essays. And they are people who represent an African-American point of view. They represent an Asian point of view. They represent the Filipinos. And they represent, through David Walsh of Washington University, a viewpoint of spectacular, emotional kind of reaction to this whole thing. When you think about all the huge white palaces that were there and the very large grounds that were there, you and I talked about a little earlier how expansive this was. The Missouri Museum, the Museum of History there at Lindell, that used to be the Jefferson Memorial, that is now the Missouri History Museum, that was the entrance of the fair. But it went all the way to like Big Bend and out to Clayton Road and all along Lindell. I mean, it was a huge space that took up the area. Forest Park is a pretty large park, but the exhibit of the World's Fair was much larger than that. They cleared trees. They brought in wood that was so expansive, it built communities afterwards. And they didn't build buildings that were meant to last. They were meant to be temporary buildings. They were built of this stuff called staff that was like a plaster Paris and straw and all other materials. But everything was white. Everything was grandiose. It was bigger than life. So it was a thing that overloaded your senses and your emotions very easily. But it was also the largest human zoo ever in the world.
The world. The history of the world.
The history of the world, to my
knowledge.
And
who would have thought about that except white Americans? I mean, come on. I don't even know where you would come up with an idea. Oh, at the World's Fair, instead of all just technology and newfangled stuff, we're going to have people on display. This continues to baffle me. And it continues to baffle me because I'm thinking, okay, however they got here, however they were tricked, controlled, or whatever, they got here, were folks responsible for them after the fair ended. And then because these people often came from tropical climates, this thing went all the way into the winter. What happened to the, did they give them some heaters? Did they give them some blankets? What?
No, is the answer to that. Yes, St. Louis has, and I mentioned the weather changes, because from April to December, you got some really different kind of weather here. And just as you said, the Filipino people were not used to that at all.
Well, Olinga was not either. He comes from the Congo.
He was purchased to come from the Congo.
Right.
And his life did not end very well at all.
No.
And he was treated and billed as a savage.
Of course.
And not all true at all.
No.
But no, he was not taken care of very well after the fair. He went to a zoo in New York.
Yeah, the Bronx Zoo.
And I have to tell you that many times when people came here to be a part of that exhibit, I'll put it that way, they weren't treated very well even while they were here. There were some kind of squabbles from time to time with the police here. There was a faction of folks who were trying to escape that whole piece. So I don't believe that they were brought here under their own all the time. So there is big question about that for me as well.
So,
but I haven't found documentation.
Stay on the premises. They could not leave, or else they would be subject to police harassment and being brought like a runaway slave.
Pretty much. Mm-hmm. Pretty much. Mm-hmm. They were brought back to the habitats where they were. Mm-hmm. They didn't have to worry about housing anybody because they lived in their habitat, so to speak. And the few times that there were people who invited them off, or they tried to, there was one group of people who just walked away. They said, "Don your American clothes and just leave." they were encouraged by people of color to do that. People of color were at the fair, and they could even get into the fair, I understand, but I don't find records. We didn't record a lot of that. There was one record of one person of color who had a concession in the Washington University administrative buildings, but that person worked for David Francis.
Oh, Francis.
David Francis. And he was the only person who was given a concession that I have been able to document. I know there were other people of color there. I just don't have documentation of. And one of those people is Annie Malone. She came.
Yeah, that was a fascinating story you told. Tell the audience about that story, because one of the things that I kept thinking was that no black folks were allowed, because every picture you see is all white people. I mean, you didn't even see janitors. So
they were there because you had some people who were human cabs. Like a rickshaw, for example.
Right.
So the whole rickshaw concept is not foreign, but you just saw black people doing it. Okay. Right. So when you talk about Annie Malone, she came to St. Louis to expand her business. So I know she was here, but I don't have any record that I can show, not even from the things that I've tried to dig up on her behalf, that says she was a vendor at the 1904 World's Fair, which is disappointing to me. Somebody has got to have some kind of record, has got to be. I'll keep digging for that. But that was one of the things she did. I know that she continued to have customers here because she set up shop here. In fact, right here at Harris Stowe, she had her second location was right here on the campus of Harris Stowe, right in front of the Emerson Performing Arts Building, her building. Her second setup was right here, and she was operating to such an extent she was making $3,000 a day doing hair in 1914, okay, wow. After the fair. Mm-hmm. So I know that she was here and doing well while she was here. But the whole point about the human zoo part is that fairs from different places in the world often had a component of unusual human beings. People who were having to live with deformities. Mm-hmm. And a lot of times that circus kind of arena, mm-hmm, was the only way they could make a living.
Right.
Okay. But it was never to the scale that it was in 1904. And when I think about the colored women's clubs, I think about those women traveling by themselves a lot of times, traveling in the very limited ways they could travel, and the dangerous nature of travel in 1904 for people of color, I commend them heartily. Those sisters
totally
were serious.
Totally fearless.
They were serious.
Right.
And I shared on that Thursday a story from a lady who lives up the street from me. She is a lady who, her mom worked for Annie Malone, but her grandmother expressed a desire to go to the World's Fair. And what her grandfather did was to plant a crop and sell that crop so that mama could go to the fair. And I thought, that's not just a historical story. That's a love story.
Yes, it
is. Because he listened to his wife, and he could not go with her. She went on her own. And to have that much faith in your wife, have that much care for something that she really wanted to do, and plant that crop and take that whole crop and make sure she had the money to go, I just thought that was wonderful. And the person who lived up the street from me, who lives up the street from me, had two vases that she still has from her grandmother. And she shared those with me. And they have on the front of them that it was the 1904 World's Fair on the one of them. The other one, I guess, is the ink is worn off of them. But she was so happy to share them. And I am more than happy to share that story, because I just think that is testament to the kind of grit people had mm-hmm. and the commitment that people had. And it's a special story about African Americans.
Yes, yes, it definitely is. Because I'm thinking, as we try to extract something positive in terms of the African American presence there, it's hard to find that except for a story like that.
There's one other, Julia Davis. We have a library in St. Louis named in her honor. She was 11 years old when the 1904 World's Fair happened. And she can recall, in fact, there was an opportunity for people to talk about and give their oral histories about the World's Fair to different volunteers at the History Museum. And when she talked with her interviewer, she shared that she was 11 years old, that she went to the fair multiple times, and on one of those occasions, she was able to touch the carriage of Roosevelt.
And she knew who that was.
She knew who that was.
Wow.
And she was very proud to have been there and been able to just touch that carriage. Now, I have not known Julia Davis. I have known of her and read many, many things by her. And pleased as I don't know what, that she was a member of the National Association of Colored Women and one of the historians that we had here in the state of Missouri. And for me to hear or read that particular interview, it was something special to me, because that was in her voice. Mm. That was something that she could recall. And as you said, is one of the small threads that we have to something positive in that particular time frame.
Wow.
And she was a positive woman.
Oh, no doubt, no doubt. You know, I think I saw a photograph of the daycare that was at the fair, because, you know, people could drop their kids off so that they didn't have the burden of, you know, dragging them along. And there was one black child in there on that particular day at that particular time. And I wondered what parents did she belong to, and how did they feel about dropping her off in an all-white kind of situation? As you said, that was not the most pleasant time for black people at the turn of the century. In fact, you know, just a few years later, we had the race war in East St. Louis. So I don't know. I just think that our folks were so bodacious at that point, you know?
It all of that's really true. And a lot of times when I look at the choice that the National Association of Colored Women made to boycott and say that this is not something that we want to go to, they made a decision that I think was a very pivotal one. And I shared this the other day. And that is, they went away mad, but they said, we're not just going away mad. We're going to tell them why we're mad. Mm-hmm. So they had a committee of people to draft a letter, a separate committee of people in charge of distributing that letter. And they said very clearly why They said, when they talked amongst themselves and they argued about whether or not they should go to the grounds or not go to the grounds, there was a St. Louis faction that really wanted to go.
Of course.
And there was a larger faction that said, we can't go because of who we are. We can't go. Mm-hmm. And they decided, we're going to do this letter to David Francis and tell him it's because of the massive discrimination and racism that we find here that we cannot participate. And they put that in a letter, and they sent it to David Francis. And they also put it in the newspaper. That, I think, is one of the
Which
most
newspaper?
Strategic. They put it in the Globe Democrat.
Wow.
And in the St. Louis Palladium.
Never heard that of
was
that
a, The St. Louis Palladium was the African-American newspaper of the time.
Okay.
And it was in both of those places in the St. Louis area. And I think the coolest thing is that the Post-Dispatch and the Palladium published those letters, and then David Francis decided to publish his response to them. So they're having this conversation in the public eye.
The public spares.
But that is what makes me be able to know about it today.
Exactly.
Had that not taken place, if the Post and the Palladium had not published those things, we wouldn't know other than in the minutes of our records.
Right.
And everybody doesn't get to see those.
Right.
So nobody, I wouldn't be able to talk about this story in 2024.
Right.
And we would not know the stance that they took. So I think that was a real important thing about the choices that they made. And it also talks about, like I said, the grit of people at that time.
Well, I really do think we should be proud of those women for taking a stance. But wouldn't you have loved to have been a fly on the wall for that discussion? Because I could see the argument for the St. Louis folks saying, we want to be a part of it because this is our city, this is historic, you know, black folks need to be there for whatever reason. And then folks said, well, wait a minute, hold up. You know, they are not treating our people right.
Correct. And part of me says, at the fair, there was one exhibit that was an example of a plantation and how it operates. And part of me said, thank you, Jesus. That was the only thing. Because if you're gonna do all that negative stuff, keep it to a minimum. It's not right that they excluded so many people. In fact, there was conversation about having a Negro Day. And the conversation was that, yes, we're going to have a Negro Day and invite people like Booker T. Washington to come and speak and other people to be present, entertainers and things of that sort. And then they decided to nix the whole thing.
Well, was the Negro Day going to be bringing in these speakers and that would be the only day that black folks here could go to the fair?
Well, they were considering to have a day a week, but they nixed all of that. And they also considered having a larger special event, and they nixed all of that. That was another thing of the time, ragtime. Scott Joplin wrote a beautiful piece of music that was emblematic of the wonderful fountains. It was these beautiful, beautiful fountains that were all a part of the fair. I mean, the beauty of the place was just, like I said, aesthetically just blew your senses away all the time. But they didn't want ragtime anywhere on the grounds. It was forbidden to do. You couldn't do ragtime.
I thought it was another white band that was able to play ragtime.
And there were, I read some things that said some of the band leaders would go rogue and do some
This came up at the Pomoja session on Sunday because I mentioned that you were going to be here, and we talked about specifically Scott Joplin, and somebody there, I don't know if it was Terry Kennedy or Johnson Lancaster, said that John Sousa, I think, might have played the ragtime that Scott Joplin should have been playing, but he was not even allowed. So if you can imagine folks finding out that the Negro Day that was trying to be conceived and implemented was all nixed, then the message to you is you're not welcome. Don't come. And that's why I'm surprised that the few folks who journeyed out of their little neighborhoods to go that far west, which at that point it was really far west, and say, I want to be a part of this. That's just astounding to me that a mother or whoever brought that little kid, dropped her in the daycare, and went on to experience that. But what it said to me, and when you mentioned that there were black kids who came to the fair on their own, I guess, they just wandered over there. And I'm thinking, okay, there might have been black kids, and obviously, but what about the adults? It seemed like there were some allowances for the kids because what they were less threatening. What was that all about?
When I read the piece that was offered by Julia Davis, I got the impression, and it was not there, but this is just context, mm-hmm. that their teachers were forward-thinking enough to try to expose them to the fair. And maybe that's how she was able to go so many times, because there were people in her life that valued the extraordinary experience, even though it wasn't always a positive thing.
Right.
They were forward-thinking enough to try to expose her to those kinds of things. Mm-hmm. And Julia Davis was always interested as an educator in exposing people to things that would help
Absolutely.
Them grow.
Wow. I just, you know, when I think about it, I you want to marvel at the kinds of things that happened there and some of the introduction of new technology and all of that. But then there's that dark side that you said, what? So, you know, based on that, do you think we've learned some lessons? And I just want to say for folks who might be interested in Oba Benta's situation, after he left here, they put him in a cage at the Bronx Zoo.
With a gorilla.
And then he went on to Europe, where he stayed for a few years. But that brother ended up committing suicide, which is something very foreign to Africans. And if you remember, the only time Africans did that is when they saw coming over here that this was not going to be a good experience. And they saw that as a last resort. But generally, you know, folks of African descent, they just stay and deal with whatever the situation is going to be. But that was the end to Oba's situation, is that he came here as a commodity, ended up being dehumanized to the point that he committed suicide. So I don't know if we know what happened to other folks that came. Were they released into St. Louis? Or were they taken back to their respective homes? We don't know that, huh?
I don't know that.
What about the folks who put on the white people's clothes and escaped? What happened to them?
They escaped. Never to be heard from again. They just walked away.
So let's tell people about some of the reasons that this was a marvel of the 20th century, because about $15 million was spent on this thing. Yes. At least that was amount raised. I don't even know how much it cost, because I'm thinking about the cost of bringing huge numbers of people and housing and clothing them and feeding them, what that must have been like. But there's that part of how much was raised. But people don't even know that they subverted a river to make way for this thing, the Pear River. They said, okay, this is going underground. We don't want this.
Exactly.
And then they had all the trees that you mentioned that were cut down. There was about 15,000 workers that were working on this thing. It truly is. And there's a replica at the Missouri Historical Society that you could see. It's a small level. But when you hear Linda talk about the fountains and all of the, you know, the structures, you have to imagine this was a spectacle. It seems like it's even more of a spectacle than the Olympics. You know what happens when you choose the Olympics and people build something?
Well, the Olympics, the very first Olympics in the St. Louis area, was something that coincided with the fair. And it coincided with a purpose. And that purpose was to be able to give reason why a lot of the brown people that they brought here were specimens that they were studying. Many people were even afraid of the very instruments that they were using to measure their size of their skull or the size of their bodies and their muscles and things. You had people who were in competition at the Olympics, but you also had some of those specimens being asked to do different challenges as well.
With the Olympians?
With the Olympians.
Oh,
yes.
My.
Yes. And supposedly the results of that were supposed to determine the superiority of the white Olympians. And that wasn't always the case, but you also had a situation where you had somebody training to do something and you had somebody who naturally did things. So it wasn't a fair contest or evaluation in the first place. But that is not a particular aspect of the fair or the Olympics that people talk about.
No. I don't even know if people know that there was an Olympic here at that same time.
Yes, there was at Washington University's campus. It's just a lot of things that were elevated in terms of the propaganda about the fair, and a lot of things that just weren't talked about because it gave a more negative light than people wanted to be portrayed in.
You talked about the millions of people that came through the doors. Do we have a sense of who they were? Were they mainly from the region, or were they?
They were from all over the world. It was a world's fair, and it attracted people from literally all over the world. There was a totally another aspect of the World's Fair that has come to me when we're talking, and it's left me at the same time. But I did want to share that part of the reason why everything is just bigger than life. That was the one thing that people just really needed to know about. For example, prior to the World's Fair, the water here in St. Louis was brown. The drinking water was brown. And they did build a totally different underwater system for their fountains because they didn't want brown water.
Of course not.
They wanted clear.
They want sparkling,
clear water. So the water department basically said, we'll have that. We'll get it clear. And they did all kinds of different experiments. And literally a week or two before the fair actually opened, they got the clear water. So they never did have to use the water system that they put in the ground for that, but we got clear, clean water. And that's the only reason why we get clear drinking water now.
Some of the best water in the country.
Some of the best water in the country. And it was a big experiment that went on a regular basis, but they were able to pull that off. You've got the birdcage here that was erected at that particular time, and it had some of the rarest birds that there were. And it's still a marvel here at the zoo. Most of the buildings are gone. A lot of people think that the pavilion that's up on the hill.
It's called the World's Fair Pavilion.
That's called the World's Fair Pavilion was built then, but it was not. It was built after with some of the funds that came as a result of that. The zoo was another thing that came after the fair. But some of those monies from the fair helped to make that possible. And there was a lot of money made.
I can imagine.
Don't misunderstand that.
Well, if you got 20 million people.
Even at 50 cents.
Yes.
It's a lot.
I mean, at that time, absolutely.
Yes, you're absolutely right.
So how much of a private entity was this? Because I know that there were lots of city departments that had to be tapped. You know, some of the street folks had to be involved in all of the stuff. As you said, the water department. I mean, it was definitely a city local government thing. But how much of it was being pushed and benefited by, you know, private developers?
Quite a bit of it. You had different business entities that had the opportunity to showcase what they did. And yes, you are correct. They benefited from that. I think one of the larger had to do with lights, electricity. In fact, the start of the fair, there was a coordinated communication system that had the best and largest broadcasting capability that had ever been known at that particular point. The president was able to push a button and light up St. Louis, okay, light up the fair, so to speak. And that was a marvel at that particular time. And all the lights, when you think having the Eiffel Tower to light up and do the little sparkling thing is magnificent. Well, I think when they lit up the World's Fair, and every night they lit up the World's Fair, that was a spectacular thing at that particular point. I think the one word I cannot get out of my mouth when I talk about the World's Fair is spectacular, because it was a thing. When you talk about the biggest you've ever seen or the best you've ever seen, all that was there at the fair. So I don't care when you went or how often you went, you were wowed every single time. Mm. And that was one of the marvels about the fair. And I think, too, that's part of the reason why some of the human zoo piece is downplayed. We talked about off air the incubators that available at that particular point. They had premature babies in a new contraption, which was called an incubator, which was supposed to be able to even out a temperature that a child was maintaining and helping them to maintain their lives. Problem was, the heaters in them were too hot. The sanitation of the area where they were, with sawdust on the floor and people coming through, they charged a particular fee to come through that particular exhibit as well. And most of the babies died.
Okay. I think it was 43 and 39 of them died.
And 39 of them died. You read the same article.
Yes, I did.
Yeah. And you had someone from the Humane Society here in St. Louis who basically wrote to David Francis and said, you need to stop this. This is not working. This is inhumane, in fact. And they did an investigation. And guess what they found? We'll change the doctor and we'll keep the exhibit. Mm. That's what they did do.
Wow. Wow.
That's what they did too. They were feeding those premature children cow's milk and cereal. You had a lot of diarrhea going on. You had a lot of babies throwing up, and a lot of those babies could not survive that.
No.
You had parents who were counting on the technology to help their babies stay alive.
Yeah, this is brand new technology being introduced for the first time.
But there are also journals that say that whole experiment set back the use of incubators by many, many years because no doctor wanted anything to do with them.
I can imagine. And probably no parent either.
At that particular point, I'm sure.
Yeah.
And that's a shame, because the incubator is a very good help to sustaining a child's life at this particular point.
It's viable. I mean, it's invaluable now in the whole neonatal world where you have premature babies. And so that definitely was and you think about babies. Somebody should have been advocating for them.
Yes.
But
yes.
I guess, you know, everything was a commodity. That's the thing that I keep getting. Everything was a commodity that was money was being made from them. And so to the extent that you could keep it, even if you had to make some adaptions, some little changes, some tweaks. No, they probably, folks were going through there at a phenomenal rate, and they just couldn't see closing that down.
Yeah. I find it's very hard to look at some of the advertisements and how blatantly they talk about white supremacy. But you look at and try to contextualize it and say, at that particular time in our continuum, that was the tenor of the day.
Yep.
So people did not find it offensive to talk in that way, except, I guess, if you were the person who's being talked about in that way.
Yeah.
But it's hard to read it now and to see how blatant that conversation was, how intentional those things were. And as I said, but for the Palladium and the Globe printing those open statements, one of the things that Francis wrote back was that, there's no discrimination intended here. We have the fair is open to everyone. We invite everyone. Mm. And if there are situations of discrimination, we'll address that.
But we know of none. We've heard that throughout the years. So there's no discrimination here.
I remember reading the words and how wide my eyes were open when I was reading it. It's like, I cannot believe they actually put this in the paper, but thank goodness that they did.
Well, here's the thing that I also thought about, and that was the and I always bring this up because it seems like St. Louis is still under the fog of the case of Dred Scott. And so it wasn't, that was 30, maybe 40 years later. But still, this whole thing about there are no rights that black people have that white folks are bound to respect, it was always prevalent. It still is, but it raises its head in different ways. And so for this man to say there's no discrimination, and then you look at a sea of whiteness.
In all the pictures that you see, sometimes when I look at pictures and I see a slightly darker person, I'm asking is, but then you look at the texture of the hair and it's like, no, it's not.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
It's almost like when you look at pictures, you are hoping to see something that's just not there.
Yeah. Yeah. But I can imagine if you were average working class black folks, would you want to even go? Because you don't know how you're going to be treated. You don't know if something might physically happen to you. So the threat of your safety was always there, and still is, for that matter, when you're around folks, white folks who have a white supremacist attitude. So anybody that, like I said, that had the gumption, the fortitude to wander over there and think that they should experience it, I just say, my goodness, you know. That's,
you don't know.
Yeah.
You would not have known, I would think, what the response would have been to your presence,
right,
or your desire to participate.
And absolutely. And I know we've run out of time, but this has been such a fascinating discussion. You can hear Linda Nance. She is actually an interactive part of the exhibit over there at the Missouri History Museum. She's telling some of the helping to you to understand some of the exhibits over there. So you can hear her again. But tell us again, in your own words, why we need to go to see the exhibit.
To expand your understanding. I have said on more than one occasion, I cannot change what happened in 1904 today. But I can inform you that those things did happen at that particular time. And because you know about them now, you can make some intentional decisions for yourself about what you will do to make things better. And I think that's real important.
Yeah. And plus, we just need to know and to talk about how we are going to progress and how we are going to try to knock down some of these barriers of racism to keep us from full participation as citizens here in the city of St. Louis. So thank you again, Linda Nance, for all of what you do for this community and helping to uplift our history in a way that we can understand and appreciate it. So, yeah.
Thank you so much.
So if you want to hear this again, you know that you can just go to JamalaRogers.com, and all of this, these episodes will be there for you next week. We have the special guest of Barbara Smith, who is one of the forerunners of the Black feminist movement. So she will be with us. But until then, this is Jamala Rogers, your host of Voices from the Battlefield. And we will see you on the battlefield. Stop.